solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Command and control is more of a mechanistic mindset. So I'm a machinist, tinkering. Trust and Inspire, I view myself, I'm a gardener. I'm trying to create conditions for the seeds to grow, for the people to grow. But the life and the power is in the seed. The life and the power is in the people. I'm a gardener, not a mechanic. It's an organic system. Command and control will focus on motivation, carrot and stick. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. It's just limited. You know, so, you know, do rewards work? Sure. They motivate people to want to get more rewards, more carrots, more sticks. But you got to constantly feed it more external stimuli.
Welcome to the 101st conversation at the Play to Potential podcast, a series of reflective conversations on leadership, transitions, careers, and life. If you've been following the podcast, you know that this is a labor of love of mine. And first and foremost, it's a space where I get to learn and grow from some of the conversations with these leading minds. We're also possibly the only podcast in the world where we slice the conversation into smaller pieces of content that we call nuggets, cross-reference the insight to something that might have been said in a different conversation earlier, and curate all that using tags that make the content easy to navigate. While you may not be able to see that when you consume the podcast on Apple or Spotify, if you went to playtopotential.com and saw the curated playlist section, you will see the nuggets organized by theme. Thank you for your support and love over the years, and look forward to having you as part of our journey where we explore some of these themes further in the years to come. While podcasting accounts for 10 to 20% of my time and effort, I must say my primary vocation is that of an executive coach and a discrete sounding board with CEOs and entrepreneurs. I engage with leaders and organizations with a growth mindset and help them play to their unique potential. You can learn more about my podcast and the work at playtopotential.com. That's playtopotential.com. I'm excited to present the next conversation with Stephen M. R. Covey. He's one of the leading thinkers in the area of building trust. He's authored three books: The Speed of Trust, published in 2006, Smart Trust, published in 2011, and Trust and Inspire, his most recent book, published in 2022. In my coaching and advisory work, one of the themes that comes up very often is leaders hitting a glass ceiling of sorts because of the default style, which is some sort of a derivative of command and control. For them to unlock their potential and move up, they often need to adopt a very different style of leadership, which Stephen calls Trust and Inspire. And that transition is not easy. It requires a rewiring across many levels. I feel that this conversation would be relevant for any leader who's looking to understand the style of leadership that's likely to be relevant and effective in the complex future that we're all growing into. Without further ado, let's dive into the conversation with Stephen M. R. Covey.
Stephen, thank you so much for making the time on the Play to Potential podcast. Really excited to be talking to you.
Thank you, Deepak. I'm delighted to be able to talk to you as well. Really looking forward to this.
Lovely. Stephen, I must mention, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People was arguably the very first book I read in sort of the genre of self-improvement, self-development, self-help, call it whatever. So in a way, it's a true privilege to be speaking to you. I also recognize it was your father who wrote that book, and in a way, he was larger than life in the way he established himself in the profession. Over time, you found your own voice and identity. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you've quote unquote joined the family business while sort of finding your own voice under these circumstances?
Yes, absolutely. Well, here's the interesting thing, Deepak, is that when I decided to join the company, this was before the Seven Habits book had been published.
Interesting.
But I knew it was going to be published, and I knew that people would resonate with it because my father had been speaking about it, talking about it for years. But until the book was out, it was hard to scale. And so I had different opportunities to join. I'd done investment banking. I had an opportunity there on Wall Street. I had an opportunity in real estate development where I'd worked before. Some exciting opportunities. And I chose to join with just a small company that my father kind of had founded because I felt like this had a chance to truly change the world, to impact people everywhere. And it didn't look like it at the time for to an outside observer, but I felt like it could. And I think I was right because the impact my father's work has had has been enormous and it's impacted people everywhere. And so, I felt compelled to that because, I believed in it and I believed in what my father was doing. And I thought it would have a great impact and that I could help be a part of that. But it was kind of difficult, especially at first, to kind of carve out my own identity, carrying my father's name. And, you know, and he was the thought leader and the speaker and the teacher and author. And so initially, you know, I came out of a Harvard Business School. And so I felt like what I could do, what I could contribute initially was a focus on the business side to turn my father's ideas into a business. And so that's where I spent my energy was focusing on that. I became, after learning the business for a while, I became the president and CEO and ran the company. And I kind of, my identity became one kind of like, well, my dad's the thought leader, you know, and I'm the business guy and, you know, building the business and growing it and forming partnerships around the world and the like. And I kind of felt like that was kind of my strength and my role. And, you know, so my dad talks about it and I helped turn it into a business and help us scale the business. And we did, we figured out a business model that worked because prior to this point, we always had a great idea, a great customer value proposition, but we hadn't figured out how to make money and we hadn't figured out how to be scalable. And so we needed to learn that. And that's what I felt like I helped bring to the firm. And then we were able to.
And this is Franklin Covey, just to understand. Yeah, this
was actually before the merger. So this was what was called Covey Leadership Center.
Okay.
Covey Leadership Center, which later merged with Franklin Covey, with Franklin Quest to form Franklin Covey.
Ah.
Yes. So the early days of Covey Leadership Center. And my role was the business guy. But then, interestingly, it was in the merger when we merged the Covey organization with the Franklin organization. Franklin was really big into time management. And we had our own foray into time management with my father's First Things First work. Suddenly, these two arch competitors in the marketplace, Covey Leadership Center, Franklin Quest, now we are combined, we're merged. And initially, it didn't work at first because not because it was bad strategy or a bad deal. No, it made complete sense.
And what's the timeline on this? When did this merger happen?
This was clear back in 1997.
Wow.
1997. So Covey was established in 83. It'd been going for 14 years. I joined in 89 when we were just, you know, a few people before the book came out. And then I became the CEO and ran it for 3 years as CEO. Then we did the merger and in 97. And at first we struggled. And it's because we were coming at it from different angles, different approaches, different mindsets, and we'd been competitive in the marketplace for years. And so there was some distrust there. And I saw firsthand, Deepak, the high cost of low trust. I saw how everything slowed down, everything cost more. And we recognized that we were not going to achieve the potential of this merger if we didn't build trust with each other. So then we made a conscious, deliberate attempt to say, we've got to build trust internally with each other in this merger to achieve what we're trying to achieve. And we worked at it. We focused on it. And we became intentional about it. And we began to move the needle on trust. And we, long story short, is we went from low trust to high trust. And that changed everything. Then I saw firsthand the great returns to high trust, how we can move faster, less cost, more creativity, more innovation, more commitment, more inspiration, more passion. And I came out of that whole experience saying, wow, trust matters enormously. And we all know that, but I came to the conclusion that we are underestimating the impact of trust by a factor of 100. Mm-hmm. That it's far greater than any of us imagine. Trust matters. You can move it. You can actually build it, grow it intentionally. It's not just you either have it or you don't. No, you can move the needle. You can build trust on purpose. And it's the most significant thing you can do. And I recognize that most of the stuff on trust, most of the books and the like, they either were too academic or too simplistic, kind of like just trust everyone and it'll all work out, you know. And I said, no, this is such a practical, tangible idea, trust and really currency. We've got to get good at this. And so I found my voice of what I wanted to do now as a thought leader. And I think I went down the business path for two reasons initially. One, I was good at it. Mm-hmm. But two, I was a little bit reluctant to try to follow in my dad's footsteps because no matter what, I was not going to measure up to 7 habits of highly effective people. I mean, that, you know, that's hard to replicate. And I thought, you know, that's a little bit daunting. But suddenly what was interesting, Deepak, is once I found my message that trust is the most significant thing, it's the one thing that changes everything and it's learnable, I suddenly lost the fear of trying to be a thought leader myself and following in my dad's footsteps as a thought leader, as an author, as a speaker. And I went down that path and I wrote The Speed of Trust, followed by Smart Trust, followed by Trust and Inspire, which we're going to talk about today. And,
fascinating.
And, but when I found my message, I found my voice and I lost the fear. And that's kind of the second act in my career. So first act, business person helping to build a business, scalable, reach people worldwide. Second act, now I also have something to say. And that's that trust is the most significant currency of our time. That's the idea. That's my two-act career.
Lovely, lovely. I'm sure many more to come. I love the way you frame it. You sort of let the voice emerge over time rather than try to sort of force your way into it rather.
Right. Yes, I didn't know it until I had something to say. I was held back by fear, and it had not emerged. So this emerged from my experience, and I earned the insights.
Lovely, lovely. So let's dive into the book, Stephen. Trust and Inspire. Just to at the outset. You in the book, along the way, you say that 30% of the organizations are operating in authoritarian command and control mode. 8% are in trust and inspire mode. But you go on to say that 62% are in enlightened command and control mode. So can you sort of talk to us about just these two terms, command and control and trust and inspire, as two ends of the spectrum, but specifically shine the light on what you mean by enlightened command and control?
Right, right. Well, you know, I mean, the basic premise of the book is that the world has changed, but our style of leadership has not, or at least has not kept pace with this changing world. Too many of us as leaders and as organizations are still operating out of the old model. Mm-hmm. And whether you call it the traditional hierarchical model, an authoritarian model, or some type of just basically, you know, a traditional kind of industrial age model, that's what we started with scientific management and the industrial revolution, all these things. And that was a good thing because we became more efficient. But over time, we started to realize that we're not valuing people in the way that we can and should. We're not tapping into their potential and talent. And so what started out kind of as an authoritarian command and control over time became better, more advanced, more sophisticated. And we brought strengths into it. We brought emotional intelligence into it and trustworthiness into it and mission into it. And it became an enlightened version. But because we hadn't shifted the paradigm, it just still was kind of an enlightened version of command and control, a much better version, but we still viewed people as kind of things to, you know, through which you get the job done. You know, even the idea that people are our most important asset, nothing wrong with that expression per se. And I get the sentiment, but even the idea that people are assets, they're things and not an end in and of themselves. And so, you know, getting results through people, well, people is just a means to an end to get results versus trust and inspire. The idea is getting results in a way that grows people. So yes, we have two ends. We got to get results, but we also want to grow people. We want to focus on both performance and people, and both are vital. We have two ends and the results and the growth of the people. So, you know, command and control is kind of heavy management oriented. You know, you manage things and people, trust and inspire. You manage things, but you lead people. And, you know, nothing wrong with management. We need good management of things, of systems, of strategies, of structures, of finances, of the inventory, of the numbers, of the business. We manage things, but we lead people. But the moment we start to manage people as if they were things, we're going to end up with no people and a lot of things because they're going to go elsewhere. They have options today. So my whole premise is that it's not enough to even kind of move from authoritarian command and control to a much better version of it, enlightened command and control, if we still view people as things. We got to shift the paradigm, cross the chasm, if you will, into what I call trust and inspire, a self-governance approach of manage things, lead people. That's recognizing the potential, the greatness, the talent in people, seeking to develop it as we get results. And so it's kind of different in kind, whereas within command and control, it's different in degree. In authoritarian command and control, in enlightened command and control, that's in much improved in degree. Command and control, trust and inspire is different in kind. Because
let's
people,
say more, Stephen. So you say it's a different paradigm. So can you sort of break it down for us? In what ways do we need to sort of, what are the different dimensions in which we need to think differently rather than just more of the same?
Yeah, well, here's a few thoughts on this. Again, I mentioned manage things, lead people versus managing people as if they were things. And no one would go out to do that. But what happens is we've gotten so good at management, people start to feel like we manage them that way. Command and control is more of a mechanistic mindset. So I'm a machinist, tinkering. Trust and inspire, I view myself, I'm a gardener. I'm trying to create conditions for the seeds to grow, for the people to grow. But the life and the power is in the seed. The life and the power is in the people. I'm a gardener, not a mechanic. It's an organic system. Command and control will focus on motivation, carrot and stick. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. It's just limited. You know, so, you know, do rewards work? Sure. They motivate people to want to get more rewards, more carrots, more sticks. But you got to constantly feed it more external stimuli. Trust and inspire. The focus is on inspiration. It's intrinsic. It's internal. It's inside of people. And whereas motivation is external, it's outside of them. Inspiration is internal, inside of them. So I light the fire within. And when that fire gets lit inside of somebody, that can burn on for months, if not years, without the need for constant new external stimuli. And so I'm really tapping into that. To inspire means to breathe life into. So I breathe life into relationships, into teams, into cultures, whereas command and control often sucks the life out of people and teams and cultures. Command and control, it's kind of compliance-based. Trust and inspire is focused on commitment. It includes compliance, but but so much more. You know, because you're really tapping into what's inside of people. You can get command and control will achieve association. It's a good thing. But trust and inspire, you can really achieve a sense of belonging and inclusion. You just can go to a different level. Command and control is good to coordinate. But trust and inspire enables you to truly collaborate among partners and teams, interconnected teams, versus mere coordination among groups or silos. You know, different in kind. So I can kind of go on and on and on. And you'll see there's a contrast. And I liken it less that good and, you know, bad and good with command and control being all bad and trust inspired being all good. Look at it this way. Be efficient with things and effective with people. So efficiency is a good thing with things, systems, structure, strategies, processes. But the moment you try to be efficient with people, you lose effectiveness. So it's not good and bad. It's not either or, it's and. Efficient with things, effective with people. Manage things, lead people. But when we start to manage people like things and be efficient with people like things, that's too much the command and control paradigm. And I might be kind about it and thoughtful and the like, but that's just an enlightened command and control paradigm. Better than the authoritarian, which is just, you know, barking out the orders. But I'm not going to really tap into the potential, the greatness, the talent that is inside of people. We won't play to our potential, to use your phrase, you know, play to potential. We won't be playing to our potential. And it was Mahatma Gandhi who said, the difference between what we are doing and what we are capable of doing would solve most of the world's problems. That's a leadership challenge and question, that we're not leading in a way that's tapping into our capabilities, our potential. And the command and control won't draw that out, but trust and inspire can and will. And in a new world of work where everything is changing, you know, with all this disruption going on, with new model, you know, a new workplace where it could be work from home, work from anywhere, remote work, hybrid work, intentionally flexible work, with all these new generations, you know, all this diversity in the workforce, new generations, as many as 5 generations at work, and these younger generations, millennials, Gen Z, and this upcoming alpha generation have completely different expectations of how they want to be engaged. Mm-hmm. And now people have all kinds of choices and options they didn't have before. There's an abundance. All these things happen. And it says the world has changed. So our leadership style needs to change with it, because we're not going to attract and keep the best people, win the war for talent with a command and control model. Mm-hmm. You can't command and control your way to a high trust culture that inspires.
And you can't command and control your way
to collaboration, innovation. We got to do it through trust and inspire. It's the only way we're going to accomplish it. That's the idea.
Lovely, lovely. Building on what you said, Stephen, you actually talk about the acceleration of human knowledge, right? What struck me was in the book, you say that if you went back to 1900, the human knowledge doubled in a century. It took 100 years for the knowledge to double. In 82, it was 13 months. And now it doubles every 12 hours. And I was just struck by just the compounding and the exponentiality of that curve. And you talk about moving from know it all to learn it all, right? I think Satya Nadella spoke about it as well. Yes. when he sort of took charge. So can you talk about that transition from know it all to learn it all? And especially, you know, if I bring in my observations as a coach, I find that very often when people grow within a function, you know, in a way they could get away with a know it all approach to leadership, because you're leading people who are a subset of their capability very often. But when you move to a CXO, to a general management role, you're leading people who know much more than you, who are often of a higher caliber. So the know-it-all really starts breaking down. And I find that a lot of people end up hitting a glass ceiling, especially around that transition. So I'd love to hear from you on what that looks like, from know-it-all to learn-it-all.
Know-it-all to learn-it-all. Just the reality is that it's happening around us with the explosion of knowledge. There's just too much for any of us to know everything. And because it's just changing so fast, and as soon as we know it, it'll be obsolete. The half-life of the knowledge is just shorter and shorter all the time. And so it puts a premium now on us to learn how to learn and how to bring in the right talent of people that know things, but also know how to learn so that we can stay relevant. I like how Liz Wiseman says, you know, we're not the genius. We don't need to be the genius. We need to be the genius maker that tries to, you know, tries to help people and fill in, you know, build a complementary team that can do that. And so that's kind of the shift that has to happen when there's just an explosion of knowledge. And we need to go from knowing to learning, and from a know-it-all to a learn-it-all. And also then to, as a leader, to bring in people that are experts, you know, because we're in the knowledge worker age today, and none of us can know everything. So All of us is better than any one of us. And so we're now collaborative. We're interdependent. We're connected on this. And it's a better way to learn. It's a better way to lead in this world of deep expertise that none of us could be an expert at everything. Just too much to learn, too much to know. And it's all shifting so fast.
Mm. And if I bring it back to the context in an emerging market like India, where there's also, you know, if I look at my early years and a lot of my peers, you know, we grow up in a context of scarcity of the number of colleges to apply to, scarcity in terms of the number of jobs. So in a way, a lot of our instinctive muscle memory is built around knowing things and signaling that as a differentiator. And suddenly you keep motoring along. It works for you for a while. And then suddenly you hit a point where suddenly you're asked to completely switch paradigms. Can you talk to us a little bit about, in the book, you talk about, you know, what happens when you sort of, by mistake, you hit your finger with a hammer and you go back to your mother tongue. Right. And you sort of liken that to the command and control being muscle memory, instinctive when under crisis. I find that it's a little more pronounced in a market like India, where a lot of us grew up in that paradigm. So can you talk to us about how we can sort of overcome that years of muscle memory to build a new set of connections to move to trust and inspire?
Yes. Yes. And I think that this represents kind of one of the challenges most of us have. Because we kind of grew up in command and control. We know command and control. We're good at command and control. We've had mentors and models in command and control. It's our native tongue. And so as we transition to a new role or new style of leadership, these kind of transitions, we want to say, I'm going to lead in a new way, trust and inspire. Because by the way, here's a way of thinking about this. Think of Marshall Goldsmith. What got us here won't get us there. And the style of leadership that got us to where we are today is not necessarily the style that will take us where we need to go tomorrow. So we need to transition. And that's trust and inspire. And yet we know command and control so well. So when the pressure's on, it's easy to revert back. So I think we need to re-script ourselves when we've been deeply scripted in scarcity, for example, or in the idea that, you know, you got to really control people instead of unleash people. We have to kind of look at our paradigm and challenge it, challenge the assumptions behind it. And, you know, a paradigm is a mental map or model that's trying to describe the territory, but the map is not the territory. And you could have a bad map of the territory, an inaccurate map. And I think scarcity might be good economic theory, but scarcity is lousy leadership theory. Because while there might be a scarcity of resources in certain situations and contexts, I acknowledge that, there's an abundance of what we can create together, of everything that truly matters. There's an abundance of respect, of caring, of compassion, of empathy, of understanding, of trust, of inspiration, of commitment, of creativity, of innovation. Almost everything that is good, there could be an abundance of those things. So we've got to challenge our paradigm. And that's hard when we've been deeply scripted in a model. And most of us have been scripted in that. We learn it in school and sports and all kinds of things. There's a win-lose, you know, winner and a loser. There's scarce resources, got to fight for them. And I acknowledge there's some context in which that is the reality. But there's other contexts in which leadership context in which abundance is the more accurate map of the territory. And scarcity is an accurate map. And so that's the idea behind it. And so here's how I phrase it in the Trust Inspire book. I go through fundamental beliefs of a Trust Inspire leader that collectively those beliefs comprise the paradigm, the mindset. Mm-hmm. And for this one, I put it this way. This is a fundamental belief of how I view leadership. I believe that there is enough for everyone. So if I buy that belief, my job as a leader is to elevate caring above competing. Hmm. You know, yes, let's compete in the marketplace, but let's care and collaborate in the workplace. There's enough for everyone. There's an abundance mentality. Now, look, I'm not naive. There might be a scarcity of certain resources at a certain time, but of most everything that is good through leadership, creativity, innovation, commitment, empathy, understanding, trust, there could be an abundance of that. So let's elevate caring above competing. This is how part of how Satya Nadella turned around, you know, revitalized Microsoft. He had a growth mindset for everyone, not just for some, not scarcity, abundance for everyone. And he inherited a workforce that was very cutthroat competitive internally with each other. And they had competed. And he said, now we got to change that mindset to caring and to collaborating and to coaching, and as opposed to competing. And so that we can compete outside in the marketplace. But it starts with the paradigm, the fundamental beliefs. And until we shift those beliefs, we're still operating in the command and control model that kind of views people as, you know, just economic beings that where some have greatness, but most don't. You got to control them. And where leadership is, there's scarcity, and leadership is, you know, you're right as a leader. And instead of the idea that there's abundance and leadership is not about rights, it's about responsibility. It's about stewardship. Mm-hmm. You know, completely different paradigm shift.
In terms of how to make this shift, Stephen, let's talk about that. Clearly, the need for Trust and Inspire is sort of glaring. It's hard to not understand that it's a need of the times. Having built a muscle memory in a certain way, what's your advice for leaders to start moving the paradigm from command and control or enlightened command and control to Trust and Inspire? What are some of the baby steps they can take to move in that direction?
I think the first step we can take is to really kind of become self-aware of our fundamental beliefs, of our paradigm. And it's hard to, because, you know, almost by definition, the paradigm is the lens through which you view the world. So even becoming aware that we all wear a lens, we're all looking through a lens, we're looking through a paradigm, and to maybe challenge it, to maybe question the assumptions that we're based upon about how we view people, how we view leadership. And so that's where I try to map out these five fundamental beliefs of a trust-inspired leader, because I believe that those beliefs are more accurate, more complete, more relevant paradigm of leadership and of people. And so challenging yourself on those and asking some questions. And so here's a way of doing it. Mm-hmm. So the very first fundamental belief, this is how you view people, is this, that I believe that people have greatness inside of them. So if I buy that belief, my job as a leader is to unleash their potential, not control them. Now someone might hear that and say, okay, yeah, I believe that. So here's a way of maybe really challenging ourselves of how deeply we believe it. It's to ask this question. Okay, I believe that people have greatness inside of them. Ask this. How would those who I lead and serve describe me in terms of seeing and unleashing their greatness? Mm. In other words, it's not me saying, I believe people have greatness. It's how would those I lead describe me in terms of seeing and unleashing their potential, seeing and unleashing their talent? Mm. And you have to be really self-reflective, because, you know, would they say the same thing that you might think, which is, I see the greatness. Too often we have a more of a limited paradigm versus an expansive paradigm on this. And we might say, well, the high potentials have greatness inside of them. You know, see, even our systems and structures are all designed with a scarcity, command and control mindset. High potentials have greatness. So you got to develop them, but everyone else, you got to make sure you, you know, contain them, control them. And people have greatness. I didn't say some people. I said people have greatness inside of them.
And you spoke about five beliefs. This is one of them. Could you sort of quickly throw the light on these? Yeah. Some of the others?
I'll quickly state them, because the reason this is important is that these beliefs collectively, when you put all five together, they comprise a more accurate paradigm, a better map of people and of leadership than a command and control paradigm, fundamental beliefs that a command and control person would have. So here's what they are. I'll go fast. First, I believe people have greatness inside of them. So my job as a leader is to unleash their potential, not control them. Second, I believe that people are whole people, meaning body, heart, mind, spirit. They're a whole person. So my job as a leader is to inspire, not merely motivate. Now, if people were just economic beings, motivation would be sufficient. If all they were was a body, you know, then motivation would be enough. Just pay them. But they also have a heart. So they want to care and belong. They have a mind. They want to develop and grow. You talk about growth and play to potential. They want to grow, develop, and contribute. And they have a spirit. They want to matter, make a difference, have impact. So inspiring taps into a better way of moving them than just motivating. So that was commentary around the belief. I'm sorry. I'll try to stay with just the beliefs without the commentary.
This is helpful. Yeah.
So I'll just repeat that second one. I believe that people are whole people. So my job as a leader is to inspire, not merely motivate. Now I shift from people to leadership. Third, I believe that there is enough for everyone. That's an abundance mentality. So my job as a leader is to put caring above competing. Fourth, I believe that leadership is stewardship. See, it's about responsibility, not rights. So my job as a leader is to put service above self-interest. Finally, fifth, I believe that enduring influence is created from the inside out. So my job as a leader is to go first. Someone needs to go first. Leaders go first. If you take those five fundamental beliefs collectively, it's a more accurate, more complete, more relevant paradigm of people and of leadership. And I could kind of go through a command and control paradigm of people and leadership, and it would be high potentials have greatness inside of them, but not everyone. And people really are just economic beings. You just pay them well, you know, so you motivate, not inspire. And there's scarcity, not abundance. And, you know, hey, I'm the leader, I'm the boss. So it's rights, not responsibilities. And we got to work on systems and structures to make the change, not I go first. I look in the mirror. I go first. So it's just a more expansive, more accurate paradigm of people and of leadership. And the reason it's important, Deepak, is until the paradigm shifts, we really won't follow with the behaviors. And it will just be an enlightened command and control. A better version. Here's a way of thinking about it. Authoritarian command and control operates on the premise of fear. That's what I can do to you. That's the old model. Most have moved away from that. Enlightened command and control operates on the premise of fairness and transactional exchange. Much better. What I can do for you. Trust and inspire operates on the premise of inspiration and partnership. It's what I can do with you. So authoritarian and enlightened command and control is still motivation. Trust and inspire is inspiration. What I can do with you. And partnering, different in kind.
And you, in the book, I loved one of the phrases you use. I think you say this in the context of stewardship. You say that you rent your title, but you own your character. I love the pithiness of that phrase. Can you sort of expand on that for us?
Yes. Well, and it came from, I heard it from Thasunda Brown Duckett when she became the CEO of TIAA, Big Financial Services Organization. And she became the CEO and, you know, new title, new role. And that's kind of position, right? Title. I got this new title. I'm the CEO. And her whole thing is, no, look, titles come and go. I rent my title. That will change. But I own my character. This is who I am. And the whole idea is that, you know, it's not just enough to have formal authority. We want to have moral authority of who we are. And when you have, yeah, position matters, but what really matters is influence. And if you have to rely upon your position, upon your title, not upon your character and your credibility and your influence, then you're, again, you're in a command and control model, not a trust-inspired model. You're using your position to get things done. And so you're talking about rights, not responsibilities. I believe that leadership demands stewardship. It's responsibilities that we have as a leader. And you know, and I in this, in Trust Inspire, I talk about there's three of them. Three key stewardships we have to model, to trust, to inspire that we have as leaders for those that we lead, those that we serve. These are responsibilities, not rights. And we do it through influence, not through position. And I could come back to Satya Nadella, beautifully modeling. He modeled, he trusted, he inspired and unleashed the potential of Microsoft by first unleashing the potential of his people.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman. I want to share my experience in the context of some work I've been doing with an organization called Antarang Foundation. Antarang Foundation works with young adults in low-income communities and helps unlock their potential by giving them aspiration, teaching them life skills, and by providing clarity to them on the path that would make most sense for them. However, when I look at the world of opportunity and the manner in which the potential employers look at these young adults, I find that it's often in the frame of enlightened command and control. They're often saying, "What can I extract from this person at this rate?" However, I truly, truly believe that while the world of opportunity might be skewed, there are some haves and some have-nots, the world of potential is uniformly distributed. There's no reason to believe that a bright kid in the slums of Dharavi is not as capable as somebody going to a posh school in Mumbai. While I may not have an answer to how to do this at scale, I must say that empirically speaking, the two people who edit this podcast, Akash Diore and Arman Bansol, are both alumni at Antarang Foundation. One of them was a ticket seller at a metro station in Mumbai. The other was a barista at Starbucks. Today they handle the social media marketing and audio editing respectively. And I personally learn so much each day working with them. Back to what Stephen says, my limited point here is that very often when it comes to our children, we are willing to think like a gardener. But when it comes to others around us, whether it's the helpers that come to us, the staff in the communities we live in, or some of the others, we very quickly move to the mindset of a machinist. It's worth reflecting on whether we can bring a gardening mindset to some of those conversations too. Not easy, but at least worth trying somewhere. If you're seeing value from the conversation, do take a moment to rate and review the show on Apple or Spotify or wherever else you consume the content. Given the proliferation and the number of podcast shows out there, it'll really help people separate the wheat from the chaff. Now, let's get back to Stephen Covey.
Talking about potential, right? How do you think about spotting potential? One of the things that very often you discover in organizations. I completely agree with you. I have an issue with this term high potentials, low potentials, right?
Yeah.
Everybody has a potential for something. So the real discussion in my mind is potential for what, right? All of us have a potential. How do you think about the term potential and measuring potential, if I may ask you?
Yes. I have a little model that goes like this. See, communicate, develop, unleash. is kind of a virtuous cycle that can then repeat. And so it starts with seeing the potential in others. That's the spotting the potential. The first thing is you need to look for it. Mm-hmm. It's like Ralph Waldo Emerson said, Henry David Thoreau, these early American thought leaders, mm-hmm. I mix them up sometimes. Henry David Thoreau said, it's not what you look at that matters. It's what you see. Mm-hmm. And so people can look at the same thing and see something different. And so you're trying to say, look, I believe that, you know, it's, again, if you have the paradigm that there's greatness inside of people, you'll be looking for it. You're more apt to spot it if you believe that paradigm. If you don't believe that paradigm, you might not even look for it and you might not spot it because the potential could be lying dormant. Maybe no one's really seen it. It's like the seeds that, I tell the story in Trust and Inspire at Death Valley, California, hottest place on earth, you know, 134 degree temperature. That's nearly 57 degrees Celsius. And it's hot, but it's dry. The average rainfall at Death Valley in a year is 1 inch of rain. There was a 3.5 year period where only 0.5 inch of rain fell. So nothing grows there. Mm-hmm. Nothing grows. It's too hot, too dry. That's why they call it Death Valley. But interestingly, in the winter of 2005, for some unexplained reason, 6 inches of rain fell in a very short period. And then just shortly thereafter, sure enough, these wildflowers popped up and carpeted the entire valley. It turns out it wasn't dead after all. Mm-hmm. It was just dormant. There were seeds that were there. They needed the right conditions to flourish and to grow. Many times people are like that. The potential might be there. It may be dormant. And if you don't have the paradigm of looking for it, of seeing it and communicating it so others can come to see it in themselves and developing it and unleashing it, you might pass right past, you know, might go right past it. It remains dormant. But if you have the paradigm, you're looking for it and maybe you'll see it. And then you start by seeing, looking for it. Then when you do see it, you communicate it to others so that they come to see it. Because oftentimes people don't see it themselves. Mm. And that's what great leadership is. Communicating. It's seeing and communicating people's worth and potential so clearly that they come to see it in themselves. That's leadership. Mm. And, you know, because, you know, I can now do this. It's like, Eleanor Roosevelt said, a good leader enables people to have confidence in the leader. A great leader enables people to have confidence in themselves because they begin to see their potential because you saw it first and you communicated to them. That's the idea. So you got to look for it. I'll give you one little paradigm on this or a analogy. I guess it's more, I don't know if it's a metaphor or an analogy, but it's the story of Michelangelo when he carved the David, you know, the statue of the David, the famous statue.
Yes.
Here's what he said. He said he had a big, you know, you start a carving with a big slab of marble, right? He said, I saw the angel in the marble and then I carved until I set him free. So he saw the David in the marble and carved till I set him free. What if as leaders, we saw that as our stewardship to those who were leading? See, if you can see it as my stewardship to see the potential inside of each of the people I'm leading and help them come to see it in themselves. I think it starts with that.
Absolutely. I was just trying to understand in a little more granularity when you say you look for it, you know, what is that it, you know, what do we need to, in terms of spotting potential in others and looking for it, what do we need to be mindful of as we engage with people, whether it's at work, whether it's in our homes or otherwise?
Yeah, we're looking for manifestations, even if it's small, of some talent, of some skill, of some gift, of some expertise. It's like Lin-Manuel Miranda, who created Hamilton, you know, mm-hmm. and is also a playwright and has written music for Moana and other things. Great talent. When he was in eighth grade, he had an English teacher, and he's supposed to turn in his homework. And instead of turning in his homework that was assigned, he turned in a musical that he wrote. Mm-hmm. And the teacher, it was Dr. Herbert Rembert, he could have just said, hey, this is not the assignment. You know, I asked for this assignment, and you turn in this, what is this? Instead, here's what he said to him. He said, wow, this is amazing. You could be good at this. And it's time you stop hibernating in my class, and you have a talent and a gift. See, he didn't, in other words, you're looking for talents. You're looking for gifts. It may be that you got the person, your direct report, they might be in the wrong seat on the bus to use the Jim Collins metaphor. Maybe they have a talent that would be better used somewhere else, but you're looking for gifts, talents, insights, expertise inside of them. It may not always be immediately manifest. It may be dormant. But sometimes you don't know about that until you maybe give them a little opportunity to show something. So it's a little bit of an iterative process of you see the potential when maybe when you start to give them an opportunity to show, to do something, to show something. And if they never give an opportunity, you maybe will never see it. And so see it as an iterative process. See, communicate, develop, unleash, give them an opportunity. And then maybe they show something. And I say, oh, I saw a glimpse. I'll bet there's more there. And then if you begin to treat people according to their potential, not just their behavior, you'll tend to move them towards their potential. And so you treat them that way too. So again, I think it's an iterative process, but you got to look for it. Again, Emerson, no, Thoreau, it's not what you look at, it's what you see. So, you know, you're looking for this so that you can begin to see it and help them come to see it. That glimpse, that gift, that talent, that skill, that expertise.
This is your host, Deepak Jayaraman, here once again. A lot of my work is with leaders who are often grappling with midlife and are trying to figure out what next in their journeys. A big part of my work with them is often about showing the mirror to them about what they really have potential for. I find that we often have a clear view of what our experiences and skills are. That's the CV level view of ourselves. But what gives us energy when we come alive is a very different question altogether. And tuning into that can sometimes give us directional cues as we think about pivoting and navigating through life. One of my earlier guests was Lloyd Reeb, author of Success to Significance. He has a beautiful phrase that captures the crux of the issue. He says that people often arrive at midlife with their passions smoldering under wet blankets. I see my job as a coach and a sounding board to lift those blankets and blow some oxygen into their passions.
That is what I have believed for a long time, that your passions are buried under blankets of busyness, obligation, and responsibility, and that if I could lift the corner and blow oxygen in, they would ignite. And so what I've been doing recently is studying the science of how interest forms. For example, there's a big compilation of social science recently done called The Science of Interest. It's a $100 book. It's very, it's like reading one PhD thesis after another. And so I've been studying that. And I think this is an area where I think I was partially wrong, Deepak. And let me share with you what I've been learning about how passion forms. So let's say that one of your listeners is in a place where they've got an opportunity to transition. Or they have some extra time because they something's changed in their life and they've got 40 hours of work at work and then they've got 10, 15 hours of free time that they could do something new and they want to make a difference, right? And so let's just say that they're looking for what their passion is. And so here's what I've been learning, and I'll just read to you some things that I think may be helpful. Many many Halftime clients or many people who come to Halftime have not been exposed to a wide variety of human experiences or causes. And as a result, they have not tasted the pain of those issues, nor the joy of those who are helping assuage the pain.
Hmm.
So it's true that for some people, you know, they might have been abused by a spouse and they're passionate about domestic violence. They might have grown up with as an orphan and they may be passionate about orphanage. Maybe they were very sick as a child and they're passionate about that. Maybe they saw their father lose a lot of money in as an entrepreneur and they want to help entrepreneurs, something like that. That happens sometimes. But more often than not, what happens is that this published compilation, The Science of Interest, suggests that people gain interest through stages. They get clear on their passion through stages, from exposure to knowledge about it, to confidence around a particular topic, and then they move into a passion as they engage with the topic and experience joy. And then this new interest becomes part of their identity. And it becomes a passion that they are self-motivated to engage in. So let me tell it to you in a story form for your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose a parent notices a child's interest in taking nature photos. So they buy the child a cheap camera. The child takes a few photos. Some turn out, but many do not. And the family celebrates the ones that do turn out beautifully. And the parent points the child to some YouTube videos to learn more about photography. Soon they begin to capture better photos. The parents buy them a better camera. And the family experiences them coming in with great pictures and they start to celebrate them. And the person feels the joy of their family seeing their beautiful pictures. And then as a result, they gain confidence. Next thing you know, they notice the child is out when it's hot or when it's raining, taking pictures, and they're self-motivated to do it. And eventually, they begin to hear the child telling people that he's a photographer. And it becomes part of his identity. So part of what you need to do if you're looking for your passion is look past at what's happened in your past. Was there a painful experience? But then, excuse me, also explore. Explore a wide variety of things through photos, through stories, through case studies, Google searches. Do an urban plunge where you go downtown and see what's happening. And I remember driving through New Delhi with a driver that was driving too fast because we were trying to get to see a congressman or a parliamentarian, right, in New Delhi, and hit a dog. And the dog was on the ground yelping behind us. And the driver didn't even look back. The driver didn't feel any compassion. And it made me sad. And I wondered, does that happen all the time? Do people and children and dogs get just hit by things? And if so, you know, what could you do about that? Now, that was an experience for me, right? It obviously moved me because I remember it was 3 years ago. And I still remember it today. That might be the start of a passion, would be to bring more compassion to animals or to children in some poor parts of New Delhi.
I love the song Besabriya in the movie MS Dhoni. There's a lovely line in the middle of that song. The question is, can we lift the wet blankets on ourselves and the others around us to unlock what really energizes us and fulfill our respective potentials? Let's now get back to Stephen M. R. Covey.
One of the thoughts here, Stephen, is that, intuitively, I understand the huge opportunity for us to move from a command and control paradigm to a trust and inspire paradigm. When I think about running businesses at scale, when you look at it from a from an artisanal perspective, if you have one or two people with you, clearly, it's easy to sort of move to that paradigm and unlock potential. When you're running a 1,000, 10,000 person outfit, million people outfit, how does one sort of run trust and inspire leadership at scale? What are some of the things leaders need to bear in mind?
Yes. I think actually it's beautifully scalable. You know, you might say, well, command and control is more efficient, but you're not going to bring out the potential and the greatness in people because there'd just be too much left there. Mm-hmm. Here's how Trust and Inspire can work. You're still working with people, but you're building the agreement together. And yes, it takes a little bit more time up front. But once you build that agreement, then you move fast and it allows you to scale. I acknowledge there's more investment initially to build the agreement, to build the relationship. But then once you have it, you move fast. So that's why I like to say with people, fast is slow and slow is fast. So if I just kind of be efficient with people, I say I'm fast, but they're not committed. They're not bought in. We don't have the same vision. We don't have the same agreement around expectations and accountability. And I have to hover over and micromanage, but I was efficient, but in the long run, I'm going to be spending a lot of time fixing things and checking on things and doing things. And, you know, it might be later, but it's going to happen at some point. Whereas if I go slower up front, build the relationship, build the agreement. Yes, it's maybe initially not as efficient, but I build the agreement around the trust I'm extending to them, expectations and accountability. Once we have that, once you build that, you move exceptionally fast. You have the speed of trust operating, and nothing is as fast as the speed of trust, and nothing is as profitable as the economics of trust, and nothing is as efficient as a culture of trust, because you're in a different place in kind. But there is an investment to get there. So I will concede and acknowledge that at scale, there is an investment that's disproportionate up front. But it is worth it because the very thing that you will gain is the speed and the efficiency that will come from it if you are willing to pay the price. Build the agreement together. There's buy-in. There's commitment. They'll be more innovative. They'll be more creative, and they'll get the job done, and you'll grow the person. And therefore, your ability to get the job done in the future has gone up because people have greater capabilities. They're grown. Whereas with command and control, they often don't grow. They might perform, but you're directing them. You're telling them what to do. So you're responsible for results, not them. If you tell them the methods, but if you give people the objectives and say how you do it, it's up to you, but let's build the agreement. Here's the results we after. Here's the guidelines we have to work within. Here's the resources you have. Now let's agree to a process of accountability. Here's how you'll evaluate yourself against those objectives and desired results. And here's why it matters. Here's the consequences of that, good and bad. You build that agreement together. There's commitment to it. And the data shows you'll perform better and you'll grow the person. And therefore, your ability to perform in the future has just gone up. Talk about efficiency. That's the ultimate.
Got it. And when I go back to my McKinsey days, Stephen, one of the things we were taught was, the principles of trust as articulated by David Meister. We were taught the trust equation. You know, trust is directly proportional to credibility, reliability, and intimacy, and inversely proportional to self-orientation. Self-orientation. I'm curious, given all your work on trust, how do you think about that sort of articulation of trust?
I love the David Meister and Charlie Green model. I think it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I have my own one, but it would be aligned with theirs, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I've spent time with Charlie Green, who's the co-author with David Meister on that. And we've done an interview together, and we both agree that our models are aligned. They're different. They come at it from different angles, use different language, but all those components, it's in my core model as well of trust. And so I like that. And, the credibility is absolutely foundational, you know, the reliability, the intimacy, but I love the idea of all over against the self-orientation, because that's to me is what I call intent. And when your intent is one of caring and of mutual benefit versus uncaring and self-serving, you know, you'll never build trust in the long run that way if it's self-serving and not seeking the best interest of another as well. Mutual benefit, win-win. Win-win is the only sustainable approach in an interdependent relationship. Or you'll just be command and control using the advantage of hierarchy or who has the power, but you won't tap into that. You know, you won't build the trust and you won't build the creativity and the commitment. And so I love trusted advisor thinking, and my model is aligned with it. I came at it from a little bit of a different angle of focusing on credibility, which is part of that, their model, but also behavior, how you behave your way into trust. And that includes needing to extend the trust to give it. Because here's what I find. You could have two trustworthy people working together, both trustworthy, and yet no trust between them, even though they're both trustworthy, if neither person is willing to extend trust to the other. So if we want to have trust, if the outcome we want is trust, yes, we have to be trustworthy. And you might call that credibility and reliability and even intimate. You're trustworthy. We're vulnerable. We're, you know, that's part of intimacy and open. We're trustworthy. But we also need to be trusting and be willing to give that trust in order to have trust. And it's possible to have trustworthy people, but no trust because neither extends trust to the other. No, they're not trusting. And I find, Deepak, as I've worked with organizations all around the world, especially the better organizations, when the trust is not where they want it to be, the bigger issue is not that they're untrustworthy. The bigger issue is that they're not trusting enough. The bigger gap is in not trusting enough, extending that trust. There's lots of reasons, because we start with a command and control mindset, and maybe we don't have a growth mindset, but also maybe we've been burned before, you know, in trusting, and we're allowing the 5% who we can't trust to define the 95% who we can, and penalizing the many because of the few, that type of thing. It can easily happen. So I call it smart trust. You know, you tailor it, and you know, it's good judgment. It's not one size fits all, but I challenge everyone to become more trusting in order to build more trust. Can I give you one quick example on this?
Please.
Just, less than a month ago, I was in Metzingen, Germany with, Hugo Boss, the fashion retailer. Great organization, great brand, and they have real extraordinary ambitions of what they want to be and become. And they're already doing phenomenal. I was with Daniel Grieder, their CEO. And he came in as the new CEO about almost 2 years ago. And he came in, and here's what he said the first meeting with his senior team. He said, "Okay, team, I'm new. I'm new to you. You're new to me," because he came from the outside. And he came in with a vision and a plan. He said, "Look, we can spend the next year. Let me give you two choices. We can spend the next year getting to know each other, you deciding whether you can trust me, me deciding whether I can trust you, you know, and we'll waste a year in doing that. Or I'll give you another alternative. We can start right out of the gates by trusting each other, and we'll move fast on this plan. So let me go first. I want you to know something, everyone. I trust you. Please trust me back. I think with trust, we can create a whole new culture. And I trust you." People there were kind of blown away. I was going to say taken aback. More than that, they're just so refreshing, so bold, you know, and he meant it. He started with trust. He was trusting as well as trustworthy. And they, people were inspired by it. They responded to it. They reciprocated and returned the trust right back to him. And I was just with them and he says, we are 2 years ahead of our plan, of our goals. And we are achieving these numbers so much faster than we ever thought was possible because we had the speed of trust operating. You know, we started with trust, but he was trusting as well as trustworthy. And so that's a simple, another model of simply bringing it about. And this is the one I highlight in Trust and Inspire. This is the second stewardship, to be trusting. The first stewardship is modeling. And you might say that's modeling the credibility, modeling the character, the competence, modeling the behavior. So you model, you go first as a leader. You know, you model the what you would like to see. So you model character, you model competence, you model credibility. Modeling goes first, then trusting. So in a sense, modeling is trustworthiness. Trusting is the extension of trust. And then we go to the third stewardship, which is inspiring. That we actually have a stewardship, a responsibility to inspire those who we lead. Mm-hmm. That's a paradigm shift for most people that don't, they think you got to be charismatic to inspire. And I'm saying, no, charisma and inspiration are two different things. Everyone can inspire. It's a learnable skill. I know people who are charismatic, but who are not inspiring. I know other people who no one would describe as charismatic, but who are extraordinarily inspiring because of who they are and how they lead, how they care, how they connect. So it's different than inspiration. Inspiring others is a learnable skill. Everyone can inspire. It is a stewardship we have as a leader. You model, you trust, you inspire.
Fascinating. A couple of questions before we wrap up, yeah. Stephen. You know, one of the things you say in the book, you say is that no extension of trust is ever wasted because its value does not lie in reciprocity, but rather in the very decision to trust. Can you talk about the nuance here?
Yes. It's a belief that saying, look, we're still trying to, we're trying to move from transaction into transformation. And if the goal is just simple quid pro quo, I do this, you do that. That's transactional exchange. So I trust you, you trust me back. I have nothing, there's nothing wrong with that. It tends to be the outcome that there is a reciprocity of trust, that when you give trust to people, they tend to give it back. But even if they didn't, is my point. That the value of you leading out, exercising the stewardship to find the appropriate way, the smart way, to be trusting of your people, of your team, of a given person, even if it's within a smaller domain, because that's what they're ready for. But you find that way to extend that trust, even if they didn't reciprocate and return it, you haven't wasted anything because the value is not in the reciprocity, in the exchange, but it's in the generosity of spirit that enabled you to extend that trust. The abundance of the mindset that says there's enough for everyone. And I want them to get the credit. I want to empower them, trust them. They have ideas. They could do this better than I could. So I believe in them and I see that. I want them to come to see it in themselves and to grow. And I can't grow. They can't grow if they don't have opportunity. They can't have opportunity if I don't extend trust to them to take on the opportunity, so they can grow. And so the value is in that very act, that very decision, that very manifestation of abundance and of generosity, not in the reciprocity alone. No, I love reciprocity. It's a good thing. I love, you know, you trust people, they tend to trust you back. But even if they didn't, I still think trusting is a better way to lead. Because I think you're being a real steward of those that you're responsible for, to trust them, to see their potential, to communicate it, to develop it, to unleash it. And how do you develop and unleash it? Unless you give them an opportunity. And how do you give them an opportunity unless you trust them?
And you use the terms smart trust, Stephen. What are some of the guardrails we need to have along the way, just so that we are pragmatic in the way we live the trust and inspire paradigm?
Yeah. Two domains. First domain is kind of as you look at the trust you're going to extend, and then we'll talk about how you extend it. Mm-hmm. So when you decide to extend trust, start with the propensity to trust, the bias, the inclination that flows from your heart. I want to be trusting as a leader. But by itself, you could trust too much, right? And maybe give people too much responsibility and they're not ready for it. They're not skilled at it. They don't have the capabilities yet. You know, there's too much risk. So you can go too far. And I acknowledge that. So you're trying to use good judgment. You're trying to set everyone up to win. And so you start with the heart, but then you balance it with the head. So the propensity to trust balance with the analysis or the assessment. And I'm assessing three things. First, the opportunity. What am I extending trust on? That's the job to be done. Maybe I'm going to say people you can work from home or work remotely or in a hybrid thing, and I trust you, you know. Or maybe it's I trust this person. I trust Deepak to lead this team or to lead this project. What am I extending trust on? What's the opportunity? Second, what's the risk involved? What could go wrong? How likely is that? What's the cost and consequence of that? And third, what is the credibility of the person or the people involved? How ready are they for this? And look, if something is lower in risk and the person is very high in credibility, you can be very abundant in trusting mm-hmm. and give mm-hmm. a lot of trust. If something is, there's a lot of risk involved and the person's brand new and their credibility is not established, you're going to be far more measured and give a smaller amount of trust. It wouldn't be smart to just completely trust someone mm-hmm. on a huge risky situation. You know, I wouldn't ask if I needed brain surgery, I wouldn't ask my family doctor who I trust to perform brain surgery because they're not a brain surgeon. They're not skilled. They're not in that, even though I trust them as a family doctor. That's beyond their expertise. That wouldn't be smart. So I'm just trying to scope it, size mm-hmm. it up. It's good judgment. It's not a one size fits all. And so I'm trying to make sure that as I extend trust, I'm doing it in a smart way, setting people up to win, including our team, myself, and them. The second is then, that's the first domain, good judgment in the extension of trust. Mm-hmm. The second is then a good process in extending that, in building the agreement together. Because whenever you extend trust, you want to make sure you always do it with clear expectations around the trust being extended and with an agreed upon process of accountability to those expectations. And I'm calling that collectively building the agreement around the trust being extended with expectations, with accountability. And if you do that well, so that it's not dictated, it's not you just top down command and control saying, here's the expectations and here's the accountability. I'm going to come back here and see how you're doing. Instead, it's a two-way process of here's what we're trying to do. What do you think? Does this seem fair? Does it seem realistic? You build it together. It does take a little bit of time, but you'll go fast later. You create the expectations around desired results, around guidelines, around resources, what we have to work with, guidelines, within what limits, desired results. What is it that we're after? Then we build a process for accountability. How will we know how we're doing? And you can move it. You can move it from you judge them to they judge themselves against the expectations that we built together. They can evaluate themselves and report back to you. They feel far more ownership. And then you can be informed and still in control, but not through micromanagement, rather through an agreement you built together. And then you also talk about the consequences involved. Mm-hmm. So expectations and accountability. So smart trust is always, whenever I extend trust to people, there's clear expectations and an agreed upon process for accountability. So if someone's working from home, I trust them because we built expectations of got to get the results. Here's what we're trying to do. Here's the guidelines, resources. Here's the accountability. Report back. in these ways. You know, you build it together. They're committed to it. They perform better around it. They become more creative. And that's so much better than dictating it, saying, do this, do that, do this, because then you become responsible for the results, not them, if you're telling them the methods they should use. Mm-hmm. And so you'll get more creativity. You'll get more growth and development. You'll get better results and outcomes. But you got to build the agreement together. That's how you extend the trust. And we go deep in this in the book, as you know, from reading it, of building a stewardship agreement around the trust being extended.
And the last thing I wanted to explore before we wrap up, Stephen, was just you say that you could be command and control in the moment, but you could still be trust and inspired in terms of paradigm. And you sort of make the distinction between what's the paradigm and what's the tactical manifestation of your leadership style. So can you sort of unpack that distinction for us?
Yeah, I think it's kind of, let me put it this way. In a sense, trust and inspire is not so much the true opposite of command and control. It's more like a third alternative. Look at it this way. If command and control is excessively hands-on, the opposite of that might be more aptly described abdicate and abandon. Mm-hmm. That's excessively hands-off. You know, there's no leadership there. There's no vision, no direction. It's just complete, hey, whatever happens, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think trust and inspire is hand in hand. So the premise is this: a trust and inspire leader can be strong without being forceful. A trust and inspire leader can be authoritative without being authoritarian. Mm-hmm. A trust and inspire leader can be decisive without being exclusionary. A trust and inspire leader can be visionary without being isolated and isolating. A trust and inspire leader can be detail oriented without being distrusting. And a trust and inspire can be in charge and have control without being controlling. So it's kind of a third alternative that enables you. So you can, in the moment, do what's appropriate. And because I've had people say, well, Stephen, I've got to go command and control right now because I'm a trust inspired person and leader, but quarterly earnings are due next week and I've got to just go command and control to get it done. And I'm saying, you can take action, strong, decisive action, and still be trust and inspire. And, you know, if you're a parent and you're a trust and inspire parent with your kids, you care about them, you love them, you're trying to help them grow and develop, you see them as human beings and you have a stewardship for them. If they run into the, you know, young 3-year-old runs into the street with cars, you're not going to say, well, I trust that they're going to see the car and they'll know to turn around and come back. No, you're going to just go in there and grab them and pull them out. Mm-hmm. So that action might look and appear like command and control, but I'm saying when you are trust and inspire in your paradigm, in your heart, those actions are not command and control. That's what the situation needed. You to just take decisive action and pull them out. But how they look and feel about that is different because they know your love and care and concern for them. Whereas if they felt like you were just a thing to them, that you didn't really love and care for them, then when you pull them out, they might feel like that was almost abusive or, you know, this and that. They interpret it differently. And the whole point is that we can still be decisive and strong in a trust inspire paradigm. And too often it gets kind of labeled as this is slow. This is soft. This is weak. You know, it takes too long. And I'm saying, no, you can be authoritative without being authoritarian. It's a better way to lead. And we can take the needed action. And if there's time constraints, you can move fast and still be trust and inspire because you've built the relationship. They know you. You've involved people. But there might be some situations where we don't have time to make all these decisions, so I'm going to move ahead with this. But you know why I'm doing it. You interpret it completely differently. It was what was needed in the moment. But we're partners. And that's what a partner does, as opposed to I work for you. And that's what you do. You know, you just do everything yourself instead of involve us. So it's just a different interpretation of everything that you might do. So I don't think there's ever a time we have to be command and control. I think you can do, be trust and inspire, including taking decisive, fast action when that is what the situation calls for.
Lovely. Stephen, it's been a wonderful conversation. This podcast is titled Play to Potential. One of the questions I ask every person who comes on the show is, what does the term mean to you?
I think it means that two things. One, we want to make sure we play to our own potential, that we all rise up and live to our potential, that it would be a shame if we felt like I'm not contributing to my potential in the work I'm doing. And so sometimes we might feel like we're not allowed to in our current jobs, but the more we can find a way to play to our strengths and ultimately reach our potential, the better. But I would say that what if we could do that as a leader ourselves and play to our potential first for ourselves, but also then as a leader of how we help others play to their potential. And that's where I say that's the pay it forward of, you know, just like each of us might look back of on a person who believed in us and helped us come to believe in ourselves. Maybe someone saw something in us that we didn't see. You know, it could be a boss or a mentor or a coach or a family member or a friend or a parent or aunt, someone that saw potential in us, someone that saw greatness, someone that gave us an opportunity, gave us a chance. How we responded to such a person, how we rose to the occasion, how we felt, how we saw ourselves differently. So you think about that. I bet most of us, if not all, have had at least someone in our life who saw in us something maybe we didn't fully see in ourselves and helped us come to see it. What if, in turn, we could become that person for another? Sure, we'd love to do it for all that we lead, but maybe we just start with one. What if we could do that for a child or one of our direct reports and help them become all that they're capable of becoming, help them achieve their potential? And if we could do it with one, we could do it with another. And so I think we first start with ourselves. I want to be that kind of, I want to live my full life, my best self, and rise to my potential. And as a leader, I want to help those who I lead rise to play to their potential. And I see it. I communicate it so they come to see it. I develop it and I unleash it. My passion is your potential. That's what I want my people to feel from me, that I want them to live at their potential. And I'm going to treat them according to their potential, not just their behavior, and help bring it about. So twofold meaning to me. First, for me, I want to rise to that level. Second, I want to help those who I lead and serve and come in contact with rise to their potential. My passion is your potential.
Beautiful, beautiful. Stephen, it's been an absolute privilege talking to you. Thank you so much for making the time for this conversation.
Thank you, Deepak. I love what you're doing. I love playing to potential. I think we're kindred spirits of trying to unleash the greatness inside of people. That's another way of saying play to potential. There's greatness. Let's unleash that. All of us. You're doing it. I'm trying to do it. And I'll bet that our listeners are trying to do it too. Absolutely. And so this is exciting to be on your podcast. I admire you and this work that you're doing. We're on the same team trying to play to potential and unleash greatness in people. And it's exciting work. It's fulfilling work. And maybe we achieve our potential as we help others achieve theirs.
Absolutely. Thank you for the kind words, Stephen. And couldn't agree more. I think, It's work in progress, but it's been a fulfilling journey trying to sort of walk this path.
Absolutely. And I think journey is the right word. And it's a journey moving from command and control to trust and inspire. We're all on the journey. And it's very easy to kind of go back to our muscle memory, our native tongue. Easy. Happens to me. I wrote the book and I still can get triggered or pressured and kind of revert back to my old scripting. But we are not a program. We are programmers. We can write the program. We can rescript to trust and inspire. That's the transition that is needed.
That's a sobering thought. that's a sobering thought given the emergence of ChatGPT and generative intelligence. The fact is we can program and we still have agency in the way we live our lives.
It's about awareness and choice. We have the agency. It's in us. Thanks, my friend. So wonderful to be with you and to dwell with all our listeners as well. Thank you.
Likewise, Stephen.
I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Three things struck me in this conversation. One, the fact that two people could be trustworthy but not extend trust to each other and how that impacts the relationship. Two, while there might be a scarcity of resources, there's an abundance of possibilities. And I thought that distinction was very powerful. And third and finally, the fact that we could be trust and inspire and paradigm but use command and control contextually in the moment. And they're not necessarily two ends of the spectrum. I'd love to hear from you what stayed with you after the conversation. Thank you for your time and attention, and look forward to having you at one of the subsequent conversations of the podcast. Bye now.